We begin today with the international developments hitting home here in South Florida. After a night of watching those streaks of an unprecedented rocket attack from Iran over Israel, they are reporting, along with U.S. and others' efforts, 99% of more than 300 drones and missiles intercepted. Though what is reported to be the fatal injury of a little girl hit by falling shrapnel. This morning, tight tension and fears of escalation, and President Joe Biden just said he would convene a meeting of allies to coordinate a diplomatic response. Rewind about 16 hours as a tense and defense-ready country alerted citizens and battened down. A plane headed for South Florida was one of the last flights to leave Tel Aviv before Israel grounded flights and closed its airspace. Local 10's news producer Yarden Ben-David is just off that flight, literally. He was in Tel Aviv visiting family and is right here at the table with us today. So nice to have you from behind the scenes to right here at the table under the circumstances.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you were at a wedding.
Yeah, it was the first wedding for the group of cousins. I couldn't miss it. And I knew that, you know, the war is ongoing and stuff, but it was something that we had to do. I didn't think that there would be drone attacks happening.
Because the war, at least from this side, the war is with Gaza, and all the attention is on Gaza and what is unfolding there. Mm-hmm. This, I suppose, is unrelated, but everything's related in a way in the complicated dynamics there. Mm-hmm. But was there anything while you were there to predict or anything to portend on the news that you should be watching this?
Honestly, I was headed to the airport and I didn't really know much about what was going on. It was a family trip. I wasn't watching the news. I was just trying to enjoy my time with my family. I went through check-in, security, didn't know what was happening at all. It wasn't until I actually sat down at the gate that my cousin called me and she was like, "Are you gonna be flying?" And then my mom called me, who's also in Israel right now. She called me, she's like, "Is your flight still going?" And then I just got call after call after call, and I'm like, "What's going on?" And then once I turned on the news on my phone, I realized that the drone attacks happened, and it was kind of frightening.
At the time that you were, and you were communicating with us in the newsroom at the same time while you were on the tarmac at Ben Gurion, and it's interesting to hear the spread of that news and the spread of the information, because you and people there knew long before we did here. But when there is a drone or a rocket or aerial attack of some sort, an airplane is going to be a really concerning place to be.
Right, exactly.
Was that in your head?
It was. I mean, we were all thinking when we were sitting on the plane, you know, people were talking around me and everyone's like, "They're just putting us on the plane for no reason. They're wasting our time. There's no way we're gonna fly."
Was that the attitude on the plane? It was just
kind of,
everyone
thought
like a
that we weren't. Everyone thought that we weren't flying.
No fear.
There were some people that were frustrated because they wanted to get back. Yeah. I personally was a little bit stressed, you know, I was scared because like you're about to go in the air when like drones are launching. Like that's not the most comforting of situations.
Is this your video that we're watching right now?
Yeah, I recorded that as I was getting onto the plane. That's baggage claim once we landed. But everything was smooth sailing. They didn't really tell us much at all.
I wonder, you know, you try to sort of glean information by looking at people's faces. I'm thinking that there's such a difference between being a citizen of Israel and being the citizen of the United States in the fact that you live with existential threat your whole life, and that's just a fact. Can you sort of talk us through the demeanor of people on that flight and what Americans might find unusual about that?
I just feel that they didn't really tell us too much, and I feel like everyone was kind of just a little concerned about whether we were going to fly or not.
Didn't know?
We really didn't know. There was a point where the pilot came on. We thought that the airspace was going to close at 12:30. That's what was going on in the news.
A.M. there, yes. Which would have been late afternoon.
It would have been 5:30 p.m. here.
Yeah.
It was something that all of us thought was going to happen. They were just going to shut the airspace. We weren't going to fly. But then the pilot went on to say that the airspace was actually closing at 1, and we lifted off the tarmac at 12:58 Wow. a.m. So they let us go. And I think I felt a little bit relieved when I was on the plane to know that I was getting out of there. But at the same time, I kind of felt guilty because my mom's there. You know, my whole mom's side, half my dad's side, they're all kind of living in fear right now, not sure what Israel's going to do after the attack.
And as you watch, and I know you and I would never put you in a position to opine on geopolitics.
Of course.
But I do want to hear, as someone with firsthand experience, we're hearing from officials, we're hearing from governments, we haven't really heard from people yet. And that's what I would like for you to fill in for us. What is there a hope? Is there an opinion of what should happen among Israeli families?
I personally don't know, besides for, you know,
totally
what I've seen. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you is that there is a lot of camaraderie on the streets right now. A lot of people are protesting for, you know, the release of the hostages that are being held by Hamas right now. There are a lot more Israeli flags than I've normally seen on the streets of Tel Aviv. A lot more people, you know, being active about the situation. I think that everyone wants, you know, the hostages to come home and for there to be peace. But at some point you have to think if that's really possible or not.
I think peace is something that everybody wants. How to get there is a very different opinions on a lot of sides. As we know from democracies, that's what happens. Yarden Ben-David, and I want everyone to know that here we call him Yarden Ben-David, but since you're just back from Tel Aviv, Yarden Ben-David, it's great to have you.
Thank
I know
you
you're
so
really
much.
Tired, and I really appreciate you coming in.
I'm actually okay.
Yeah,
not
for
bad.
Now.
For now.
All right, thanks so much.
Of course.
All right, and stay with Local 10 and ABC, of course, today for continuing coverage on Israel at War. Updates throughout the day on air and also online at local10.com. So we turn now to a game-changing new law signed by the governor this week, taking the teeth out of the state's 21 civilian panels formed to hold law enforcement accountable for their actions. Many, if not all, were created to foster trust in the community that the fox is not watching the hen house. But this new law, known by its House Bill number 601, is supported by those who say local, state, and federal agencies already have the role of policing the police. The governor held a law enforcement event to sign the bill this week.
These things have been political tools. So, yeah, they can meet, they can exercise whatever First Amendment freedom. They're not going to have any right to initiate disciplinary proceedings. And that's a very firm line that they've drawn on this bill. And I think that that's the appropriate line.
With us to take that dive is Ursula Price, Executive Director of Miami-Dade's Independent Civilian Panel. And via Zoom with us today, Rodney Jacobs is the Executive Director of the City of Miami's Civilian Investigative Panel. And it's great to have you both here. Rodney, you have been at the table with us before. So now we'll do like a little three-way chat. And I want to start out by, Ursula, since you're here, welcome. Let's start with you. You heard the governor just say this was, he feels like this was, these panels are political tools. How do you hear that?
I think that's an interesting perspective. From my perspective, everything is political. People.
And that's not a pejorative per se. It's not a bad thing per se.
No, politics are about, you know, I majored in political science. Politics are about the distribution of resources and power, right? Some people believe that there is an imbalance in communities between police and community. And this is a solution to that imbalance.
And we'll dive into what solution might mean, because I think you just kind of spoke to this whole dilemma. What is the solution for getting people, communities, and police departments to work together and be one trusting community? Rodney, if you are with us, there you are. So Rodney, I want you to, you know, we've talked a lot about this in the past, and I want to, now that this law goes into effect in July, effectively we have two more months of doing what you do, but why is this political? Why would it be political?
You know, I think some may see it as political for multiple ways. I think when we look at our work that we do on the day-to-day, and I think Ursula can attest to this as well, we don't look at our work as political. We look at our work as really benefiting the community and even benefiting police officers as well. We've been doing this work now, at least in the city of Miami, for almost 20 years. And we wouldn't be able to stay focused and disciplined on our work if every time something political, quote unquote, in nature comes up, we didn't get involved in it. So I think it's unfortunate that the governor and really the state legislature has taken this approach to the work that we do, especially in the city of Miami and Miami-Dade County at large, because I think we've seen great benefit and meaningful work come from our presence there over the last two decades.
So in the press conference, the governor and also Mark Glass, who we're going to hear from in just a minute, who is the commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Commissioner Glass had raised the point that there are all of these agencies who do police the police. There is locally the state attorney's office, prosecutors, but there's FDLE at state level. There's the FBI. There are internal investigators within police departments. I mean, there's just a whole roster of police review. And I want to let people hear what the commissioner had to say at the press conference about that on Thursday.
These men and women do not need to be scrutinized again and again by a committee that has no idea of what they're talking about. And on the 601, it requires them to have a law enforcement retiree at least on that board from 3 to 7 people. That's fairness. And that's
So what he's talking about the part of the bill that actually creates civilian panels, but by department and with the sheriff overseeing them. Mm-hmm. But what he said was so interesting. They don't need people to scrutinize what they do. What do you think about that?
I think that is part of the fundamental misunderstanding about what civilian police accountability is. Our focus is not punishing individual officers. We at no point have had the power to do so. We help bring civilian perspective into policy making and analysis of the police department and what our criminal justice system should be.
But why, and I'm gonna play devil's advocate here, I just wanna be firmly on the record. I have no stake, I have no horse in the race, I have no politics or partisanship, but I do wanna challenge some of what you're talking about. Why would a police officer need to be scrutinized by a civilian who has never been in his or her shoes, never been trained to do what they do, never had firsthand perspective on what they do?
What I'm saying is a police department should be scrutinized by the civilians that it serves. Civilian police accountability is not about scrutinizing individual officers. It is about looking at departments.
Okay, but Rodney, let me bring you in here.
Yeah,
City of Miami has scrutinized officers.
Yeah, so I think this is a fundamental part of democracy. Let's look at this from two ways. The FDLE commissioner and the governor have both stated that, you know, these panels shouldn't have any disciplinary power. And thanks to a law enforcement bill of rights, we've never had the power to actually discipline officers. What I think we're looking at here and what the police department and police unions have tried to blur the lines on is that we shouldn't be able to scrutinize and or critique police department actions. And really that just runs afoul of actual logic. Last time I checked, Lena, juries were something that are still regularly used in our criminal justice system. And those people typically are impaneled and don't come from the backgrounds of the individuals on trial for malpractice. I'm not saying that we're a judge and jury and civilian oversight, but it is not uncommon, and in fact, it's part of the natural fabric of democracy, to have civilians critique instances of officer misconduct just as any other profession gets those levels of critique. Now, I will add an additional layer to that and say that the civilian staff is of the same profession. At least in our department, we have individuals that come from law enforcement backgrounds or investigation backgrounds. So these are individuals that not only are professions within that field, but also runs in line or in tune with the basic core compounds of democracy in America. And that sometimes is, you know, individuals that are your peers looking over your work when it involves some type of misconduct or malpractice. And I think that's completely normal and fair. And I really think it bolsters what we call procedural justice in our profession. It's that the notion that community members and other people that aren't from the profession perceive the system as fair and thus allows for law enforcement or public safety to run in a way that's more effective for everyone involved.
All right, Rodney, sit tight for a second. Ursula Price, sit tight. We're going to take a very quick break and pick up this conversation from there when we come right back. We are back with Ursula Price right here, Rodney Jacobs via Zoom, both executive directors of their respective civilian panels in Miami-Dade and City of Miami. And I want you both to hear something that Stedman Stahl had said, who is the president of the South Florida Police Benevolent Association, essentially the police union. Mm-hmm. He was here with us a couple of months ago. So let's listen to something he said about this new law.
And I sat through these things where discipline hearings where elected officials hit the rewind button 9 to 10 times to see what happened. I said that officer didn't get to hit the rewind button. They had a second to make the decision. So when you have this, I think the money that's spent on these departments would be better off continuing training, work with the community much more, bring them in. And we do it now with these coffees with cops and the cookies with rookies and those different programs. It's put the money back into training and stuff like that, and we get the same results.
So he's making the point that there is already work to get the community's trust in the different departments. And do you think that's fair?
Community outreach is a good investment of departmental time.
Yeah.
But I want to be clear, community perspective is not in having coffee with an officer. Community perspective is there racial disparity in how people are treated? Are our young people being treated fairly when they have police interactions? Those are the community perspectives that are material.
And have you ever found in your investigation of a case something that had not been found along those lines?
Absolutely. In our scrutiny of the complaint process for Miami-Dade Police Department, we found things that civilians would care about, like the fact that most people don't get an answer to their complaint. Mm. Or that not all complaints get a full investigation, disposition, and review by the chief of the department.
Procedure.
The process is what we can contribute to.
Got it.
The civilian perspective on how the process should meet their needs, not just the police department's needs, because this is a partnership. Policing doesn't happen just by police officers.
Mm. Rodney, so as of July 1st, there is no, you don't have to go away, but you certainly don't have the powers that you have now with the CIP. So what happens next? What's the plan?
Well, I think right now we're still analyzing the law and we're seeing how it impacts our department more specifically. But I think there's still a lot of value that can come out of our department as well as other departments around the state. I think you see here with the law, although it seems like the legislator may be talking out of both sides of their mouth here, that they understand that civilian oversight is a necessary component that makes our public safety system work, but they just don't want civilians doing it. Although on the very same turn, they also allege that they have enough oversight as is. So I think there's a lot of gray area with this law right now, and we're still trying to determine how it best fits and what will the next steps be.
And is that sort of the take the county is taking as well?
Absolutely. This is actually happening in other states, right? So we have a lot to learn from how things went in Tennessee and Arizona. I come from an oversight agency in Louisiana that had no investigative power. And yet we had a tremendous impact on the New Orleans Police Department through audit, review, policy making, civilian engagement. Those are all parts of police community relations that are not being served by any other department.
And was there was there a law about that, either in support or opposing like we have now?
Yes, in Louisiana, New Orleans has an ordinance that created a police oversight agency that it called a monitor, right? Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of cities that have these different oversight agencies. And in many, there has been state legislation that attacked their ability to do their work. And in each of those instances, those cities changed their ordinance to do more evidence-based analytical work instead of investigations.
Rodney, part of this bill is to create exactly what you do, but under the auspices of the sheriffs of the different counties. Do you foresee, I mean, we have about 30 seconds or so left, do you foresee your panels being folded in some respect, in some way to that?
It could be. I think that's a foreseeable conclusion one can make, but it's still, like I said, there's still a lot of gray area with this law. We're gonna analyze it as best we can and try to do what's best for the community to uphold public safety moving forward.
So I guess that's our favorite saying, stay tuned, more to come. Rodney Jacobs, Ursula Price, great to have you. And thanks. Definitely keep in touch with us, because it's important to have police departments in the community really working as teamwork. And I feel like news departments are certainly part of that process. So great to have
you. Thank you.
All right, and we will be right back. Know we want to hear from you about what you heard today or anything in the news, really. You can connect with us really easily, email, or you can reach out on social media, Twitter, X, Instagram, Facebook, Pickett, Glenna, at Glenna, WPLG is the place. We thank you so much for spending this time with us on this short edition of This Week in South Florida. Remember, keep in touch.